Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for an hour each weekday afternoon. This is Friday, the end of our broadcast week, your last opportunity before the weekend to get through with a question you may have and you may want to ask on the air about the Bible or about the Christian faith, anything related to those things, or if you want to balance comment by presenting a view contrary to that which is held by this host, you're welcome to do that as well. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Stella, calling from Las Vegas, Nevada. Stella, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. I was calling today because I am going through your series of the foundations of the Christian faith, and we're studying the faith part now. So I got through the first part. It's a sister and I who are listening to your lectures, but we heard that you referred to Ephesians 6, verse 8, and how there's different points of view. Some believe that when it says that, not of your own, they think that it's faith. Others think it's referring to salvation. So it's funny because this past Sunday, our pastor mentioned that, and he was saying that, I guess he's of the view where he thinks that refers to the faith. And so he explained this because that is the means to salvation, which is faith. And then he referred to Galatians saying that faith comes from the Spirit, and then he referred to Matthew 17:20, where Jesus makes a reference where faith is those of little faith. So anyway, it formulated two questions to me. One is, where does faith come from? Because based on the lectures, I understood that we're born with faith. I think you mentioned in one of the lectures that we are creatures of faith, and the examples you gave were great examples about how we really just we do trust. The second part was, if we all have faith, why does Jesus refer in Matthew 17 to those of little faith, or if we only had faith as a mustard seed?
Okay, so I mean, there are quite a few points brought up here. Is the main question, why does Jesus ask them why they have such little faith? And if we all have faith, in fact, is that what you're asking?
Yes. Well, the first part is, where does faith come from?
Oh, okay. Where does faith come from? Well, faith is not a thing. It's not actually a thing. It is simply a reference to believing. If you have faith, that's just a way of saying you are believing. If you don't have faith, that's just a way of saying you're not believing. There's certain words in our language that are nouns, but that they refer to actions. For example, the word thought is a noun. There's also a verb. Thought can be a verb, but there's also a noun called thought. You know, my thought was this. That means my thinking. Okay, so a thought is the act of thinking. Speech is a noun, but it's the act of speaking, which is a verb. Faith is a noun, but it's the act of believing. There are words that are nouns, but they are not things. We usually think of a noun as a person, place, or thing. But in fact, in many cases, a noun is simply referring to an action which has come to be summarized with a noun word. So that believing is something you do. You either believe or you don't believe when you hear something. Now, you believe if you think the person is credible. You don't believe if you don't think the person is credible. It's, when I mentioned we are creatures of faith, I don't think I said we are born believing, because I don't think we're born having any kind of rational thoughts at all. But we are born with a nature that compels us to believe things. And we will soon be believing. The child will be trusting his parents eventually, and trusting, as he grows older, people that seem to him reliable. And we eventually, even as we grow up, we have to in some measure trust authors that we read, or else we can't believe anything they say. We have to trust our politicians in some measure, which is very difficult at times. But we either have to trust them or just totally, not pay any credit to them at all, pay any attention to them at all. Because if we don't trust them, well, I mean, we won't know anything. Trust is how we come to know things that we don't discover for ourselves. How do I know that there was a George Washington? I didn't discover that for myself, but I trust people who were there who did know George Washington, who have left records of that, and so I can know that. Faith is simply believing things that you've heard, and basically it's attributing credibility to a witness. It's pretty much what it comes down to. If somebody bears witness to a fact and you attribute credibility to them, then you believe them. If you don't accredit credibility to them, then you won't believe them. So faith is simply the natural response to judging that somebody is an honest and faithful witness. Now, believing God comes from us making that judgment of God. Will we believe what God said? If we don't, it's because we don't believe he's a true witness. And that's a judgment we make of his character, a negative judgment we make of his character. If we do believe him, it's because we judge that he is a reliable witness, and that's a positive judgment we make. So faith is really a judgment of the credibility or the reliability of somebody who's telling us something. That's what faith is. Now, where does that come from? That comes from our own rational thinking. My own rational thinking, when someone speaks to me, has got to make some kind of a judgment. Does they seem credible? Do they seem reliable? Are they showing signs of being dishonest? Do they have authority? Do they have expertise in the subject they're speaking on? I have to make judgments like that before I know if I can believe them. Now, I have to do the same thing with God or with the Bible or anything else that I believe as a Christian. I have to make a judgment of it. Is it reliable or is it not reliable? Is it a credible witness? And if I judge that it is, this is a rational judgment I make. And as a result of judging that it's reliable, then I rely on it or I trust it. So faith is not, where does it come from? It's a process. It comes from a process of thinking. That's why you believe certain things and not other things, because people have told you things, some of which you believe, some of which you don't. If you don't believe what they say, it's because you either think they're liars or you think that they may not be liars, but they may not be competent to speak on the subject. They may not be expert. They may be saying what they think is true, but they don't know. Now, in the case of God, he is neither a liar, nor is he capable of being misinformed. And therefore, Christians judge that God is a reliable witness, and therefore we trust him. People who don't believe God, it says in 1 John chapter 5, whoever doesn't believe God has made him a liar. Well, of course, you can't say I don't believe God without saying I think he's a liar. So obviously, faith is a judgment you make of God's honesty. You figure he's honest and competent to speak on the subject. He's an expert on what he says, and therefore I believe him. It's a natural thing for human beings to do when they make proper judgments of character.
Okay, got it. And
when I said all people have faith, that doesn't mean all people have faith in God. All
right.
People exercise faith on a regular basis. We trust our spouse, we trust our parents, we trust our friends, we trust our employers to pay us. You know, if we didn't trust our employers to pay us, we wouldn't go to work, because we're going to work for, let's say, a week or 2 weeks before we see any paycheck. But we're doing it. We wouldn't go if we weren't trusting that the employer is going to be honest and give me a paycheck. That's trust. We live by trust all the time. Whenever we make a contract with anyone, whenever anyone promises anything, if we live with the assumption that those things are true, then that's faith. So, I mean, faith is what we all do, but not everyone has faith in God. And when Jesus said, why is it that you have so little faith? He means faith. Why do you have so little faith in God?
Okay. And same thing when he says faith as the size of a mustard seed, it's also in God.
Well, yeah, Jesus is always talking about faith in God. Jesus never advises us to have faith in anything other than God. He's always talking about faith in God.
Okay, got it. Well, thank you very much, Steve. It does give a little more clarity.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Stella, for your call. Sharon from Sacramento is next. Sharon, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I was wondering, I heard something about the reason why Paul changed his name from Saul is because Saul was Hebrew name and Paul is Greek. And he wanted to be an ambassador for, you know, he wanted to his ministry was to the Greeks. So I was wondering, have you heard anything about that, or is there any history or validity to it?
Well, I think it's probably true. We're never told that that was his reason, but it makes sense that that would be his reason. He was always called Saul while he was ministering among the Jews. His Jewish name was Saul, but he was also a Roman citizen. And as a Roman citizen, he had a Latin name also, which was Paulus. And so he had the Jewish name Saul and the Latin name Paulus from the day he was born, or at least from the day he had Roman citizenship when he was born with that. So
Saul is actually a Hebrew name. That's correct.
Yes, Hebrew. Yes, there was a King Saul, remember?
Yeah, Israel? Yeah, I figured that just to be sure.
Right. So Paul was born with a Hebrew name and a Latin name as a Roman citizen. Now, he went by his Hebrew name when his activities were only involved with Israel. When he was sent out on his first missionary journey to the Gentile lands in Acts chapter 13, we first read of him, it says, Saul, who is also called Paul, is what it says. And then from that point on, he's always referred to as Paul. Now, we're not told why. We're not told why at that point he stops being called Saul, but we could assume that since that coincided with his beginning of his Gentile outreach, his Gentile missions, it was probably in order to relate more with the Gentiles that he used his Gentile name instead of his Jewish name.
Okay, so that's more of an assumption. It doesn't say that in Scripture anywhere.
Right, the Bible doesn't say anywhere,
okay.
But I think
it doesn't
it's
say
a,
it doesn't say anything. Correct.
It doesn't say one way or another. It doesn't say one way or another why he called himself Paul.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a fair.
I wasn't
assumption.
Sure if I missed it or not. I was like, I don't remember it giving a reason. And
right.
So I was just, it made sense to me, definitely. So I was just wondering if you had any more information on it. So thank you. That was my question.
All right, Sharon. Thank you for your call. We have a line open for you now at this number, 844-484-5737. If you want to call, you can get in line. We're going to talk next to Emil from Toronto, Canada. And if you want to call this number, you can get in line. We'll talk to you, too, if you have a question or a disagreement with the host, feel free to call. The number is 844-484-5737. Emil, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. It's Emil. Thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
I've listened to a lot of your audio recordings on your website, and I had a question about marriage. Now, my question is, when I read the Bible, I don't see anything in the Bible that says you should give vows in the Bible. When you're getting married. It seems to me that God is the one who created the vow in Genesis chapter 2, I think it was. And giving a vow when getting married seems to be contrary to what Jesus said when he said in Matthew chapter 5 that we should not swear at all. So I was wondering, what is the biblical basis for giving a vow when you get married rather than just sticking to what the Bible said in that,
the reason that vows are made, I mean, we could call them promises if we wished instead of vows. I mean, we do call them vows because marriage is a covenant. And when two parties make a covenant with each other, they make certain promises. They're very solemn. Usually they're called vows. Now, when Jesus said don't swear at all in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, he was talking about something very specific, which did not, I think, include a forbidding of marriage vows. Although, you're right, the Bible doesn't anywhere say that vows have to be taken during marriage. Lemuel, in chapter 31 of Proverbs, King Lemuel's mother refers to him as the son of her vows, but that doesn't necessarily mean marriage vows. It might. It might mean vows that she made about her son, like Hannah made vows about Samuel. It's hard to know exactly what is meant by her calling him the son of my vows. but could very well refer to wedding vows that she had made. In any case, the purpose of vows is simply to affirm in a solemn way what you are agreeing to and what you're promising. And in marriage, people are definitely making a promise. Now, whether these vows are stated as such or whether they are implied and understood by all parties would make a difference. For example, in ancient Mesopotamia, before there were any biblical people, that is, before Abraham's time, there were biblical people, of course, but before the time there were Israelites, we know from what archaeology has uncovered that the way ancient Babylonians got married, and probably the way that Abraham married Sarah, was by saying, the man says to the woman, "You are my wife." And she says, "You are my husband." And that's what they do. Now, that doesn't sound like a vow. That sounds like an affirmation giving information almost. But indeed, there was in the word husband and wife, which are used, inherent promises. You know, that I'm going to be to you what a husband is supposed to be, and you're going to be to me what a wife is going to be. That wife and husband were not just terms that they were giving their own definitions to secretly that no one knew. It was a very understood role that they were affirming. Now, they may not have said, in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, as they do in Christian weddings sometimes, but in any case, they are making a promise to each other. And I don't think that a marriage exists unless such a promise is made. Now, the promise may not be enumerated. It may be implied in some measure. For example, in modern weddings, the vows often say, "I take you to be my wedded wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, in sickness and in health, for richer, for poorer, for better, for worse, and forsaken all others, to cleave only to you as long as we both shall live." That's a long way of saying what everybody understood marriage to mean, when in ancient Mesopotamia they just said, "You are my husband," or "You are my wife." All that was implied, but it is sort of spelled out in modern vows. Now, if someone doesn't like the idea of taking vows in such a formal way, I'm not really sure what they could have against it, but if they thought that Jesus was forbidding it when he said don't swear at all, I think they need to understand that what Jesus was talking about is that you need to be honest enough that your word is your bond, whether you have sworn or not. He actually is not forbidding that you ever swear, because Paul himself and Jesus himself was put under oath in court. And Paul was too. And Paul actually on a number of occasions swore by God. He said, "As God is my witness, this is true." A number of times, once in Galatians chapter 1 and elsewhere as well. "God is my witness," he'd say. That's a way of swearing by God. So what is forbidden in the Sermon on the Mount is not so much that you would swear, but what Jesus is teaching is your word should be such your bond that your yes should mean yes and your no should mean no. If you add anything else to it, it should add nothing of value, because your yes should be as binding to you as if you had sworn an oath with it. So why not just give up on the oaths altogether? Why not even just not swear? Now, he's not commanding you not to swear. He's not saying it's wrong to swear. He's simply saying that it should be absolutely unnecessary. And in the society that Jesus was teaching that, the Pharisees had certain oaths that they recognized as binding and some oaths that they recognized as non-binding. And Jesus talks about this and rebukes them in Matthew 23 when he says, you Pharisees, you say, if you swear by the temple, it means nothing. But if you swear by the gold of the temple, it means something. If you swear by the altar, it means nothing. But if you swear by the gift on the altar, it means something. In other words, they had all these fine-tuned laws about which oaths are binding and which are not. And you had to be a legal expert to know which was which in their thinking, so that they could actually take an oath to you and promise something to you and make an oath, but they knew they were making an oath that was not binding, but you didn't. So they were deceiving you by taking an oath which they didn't intend to keep. This was very commonplace, apparently. Jesus called them on the carpet about it in Matthew 23, and it's no doubt what he has in mind in Matthew 5, when he says, listen, if you swear by heaven or earth or whatever, you're swearing by God all the same. You swear by heaven, it's God's throne. Swear by earth, it's his footstool. You shouldn't even swear by your head, because you don't have the power to make one hair white or black. What he's basically saying is all these different oaths that people take, it just gets me a tangle of legal finery in the Jewish culture. Why don't you just say yes and mean yes and consider yourself bound by your word, bound by your integrity? He's teaching that you need to have integrity. He's not actually saying that people who take oaths are doing a bad thing, but he's saying they might be. People who take oaths sometimes are doing a bad thing. They're taking an oath that they consider not binding, and they're deceiving the person they're speaking to into thinking they're making a binding oath, and thus they're deceiving and cheating. And Jesus said, let's get rid of all that altogether. Let's just say, let your yes be yes and your no be no. So he's not really teaching anything that makes wedding vows or any other kind of vows in themselves a bad thing. And if you had a wedding without vows, well, I guess there has to be something else that is stated. You have to at least announce that you're agreeing and promising certain things to the party, or else what's the difference between that and just shacking up? No, marriage is established on a covenant, and a covenant has to have some kind of agreement, generally a verbal agreement, between both parties.
Okay. Well, you mentioned shacking up. I guess that was part of my question as well, because I was wondering, what is the legal status of shacking up in the Bible? You know, I guess that's part of my whole question about marriage. If two young people shack up and do not say the vows, aren't they still married in God's eyes? They have a sexual relationship. They may have children.
Mm. Well, why would they? Why would they be married in God's eyes if they haven't gotten married?
Because this husband, they have left their parents and they are now living together. Isn't that what Jesus defined as marriage?
Well, there's certain implications in that. Jesus never conceived of a marriage that didn't involve a marriage. In other words, marriage is a contract. It's a covenant. You don't just say, I like you, let's sleep together. And in fact, let's live together and sleep together regularly until we don't like each other that much, and after which we can leave each other and marry someone else or get with someone else. No, if you're talking about a couple that has made lifelong, unconditional, lifelong commitment to each other before they slept together, then that essentially is what marriage is. But if they have done so, haven't they told anyone? You know, marriage is not just a private matter. It's a social matter. It involves both families, their parents. The parents of both parties should be involved and should be approving. Probably the social group they're in, certainly the church they belong to, should all be involved in it. Or else, what is it? I mean, why would they not do that if they really have those intentions? I don't know very many young people who have shacked up and avoided getting married who have the lifelong commitment to each other that marriage implies. And if one of them has it, they don't know if the other has it because they haven't made any vows. The point is that a marriage exists when two people have agreed to a lifelong relationship to stay together until one of them has died. Now, I don't know of any, I mean, there might be some. But I've never met a young couple or an older couple that are living together unmarried that have that commitment. If they do, why not get married?
Okay. All right. I have some more questions, but I'll call and ask back another day.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your call, Emil. All right. Our next caller then is Michael from Live Oak. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Michael.
Hi,
how are you doing?
Steve. Good to hear you as always. So before I get to my main topic, I wanted to ask you, is Yeshua the name of Jesus in Hebrew?
Well, that's the way many people think it was pronounced, yes.
All right. Was that his given first name? Because I know Christ means anointed one.
Christ is Christos in the Greek, right. It's the equivalent of Mashiach or Messiah in the Hebrew.
All right. Mm-hmm. But Yeshua or something like that was his actual given name?
Right. Yeshua is the Hebrew form of the name Jesus.
All right.
Yeah.
And so did people just have one name back then? There were no last names?
Well, they didn't have a last name, usually.
All right.
But they were known as the son of.
And
that's how last names often got started. Like if you meet someone named Peterson or
that's
Johnson
right.
or Thompson.
That's right. Right.
Or Jacobson. Usually that's their last name, but it really evolved into a last name from being son of Jacob, son of Tom, you know, son of John, son of Jack, or whatever. So in old times, a person was known by his given name and his father's name. Now, sometimes, if they had a very common name, and perhaps their father had a very common name too, they might be known from their geography. So that Jesus, who had a very common name in Israel, there were lots of people named Jesus because it was actually the name Joshua, and his father's name was Joseph, and lots of Jews were named Joseph because that was a famous biblical character too.
Right.
There must have been lots of Jesus, the son of Joseph's around. So he was usually called Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph.
All right. My uncle, my mother's side, Robert Greenberg, and he went to Israel in the 60s, and he had a very inspired. He was, I don't think he was particularly religious before that. So he came back and he said, no, Reuben ben Yosef, Robert.
Son of Joseph,
That's right. I guess Robert, Reuben is, I guess, Robert in Hebrew. So, yeah,
well, it's close. I don't know if it's the equivalent, but it is definitely close in vocalization. Yeah,
that's right. And I think he did that legally. I think that was his official new name. Yeah, anyway, Steve, I tell you, I can almost become a Christian at this point. I go to the men's Bible study group, and it's just so beautiful. I'm just so touched consistently week after week. And I'm understanding Christianity in a new way.
That's good.
And
is that the group over at Calvary Aptos?
Yeah. Gentleman George is usually leading it. And I wouldn't miss it for anything. And I still attempt to practice the Buddhist path that I'm on. And I don't see those in conflict. But I have to say, when I was young, and I had some really unfortunate, sinful things going on, proclivities.
Mm-hmm.
And, it would have been wonderful if I, because it was so deep. The power of the Holy Spirit through the agency of the church, I mean, it just as we hear classically in these accounts of conversion or born-again stories, just it's basically the power of love. And that is just so clearly communicated through the church or whatever, however that works.
Yeah, it's good that you've experienced that, because some people have experienced contact with Christians and they wouldn't come away saying that's the main thing they've gotten from it. But in a good group of Christians who are really following the Lord, that is what you're going to find. Jesus himself said that you'd find that. But in addition to the power of love, which might be sometimes found outside of Christian, religion too, certainly, Christianity also has the power of truth behind it, in that it's a true story. It's a story about a real appearance of a man on earth named Jesus who did and said certain things, who died and rose again, and who started this phenomenon called the church. And, if it's a true story, then Christianity is valid. If it's not a true story, Christianity is not valid no matter how much love you feel when you're around Christians. In other words, the truthfulness of the story is essential to the validity of the faith. But of course, when people are true followers of Christ, they are supposed to be recognizable by their love for each other. And I'm glad that you have met Christians who exhibit that, because some people meet people who claim to be Christians and who don't seem to exhibit that very much.
Well, see the thing is, the what I'm calling love is the access in one's own experience to the power. In other words, normally the usual tendency is somebody is unkind or rips you off or whatever, to give rise to anger and bad feeling, and the power to not do that, the power to remain, to keep one's heart open and to still experience that universal agape quality towards even those who are.
Sure, that's a true sign of being a real Christian. Now, you mentioned that you almost could become a Christian.
Yes.
There must be something still, one barrier there that's keeping you from doing so. What would that be?
Well, as I said before, there's a distinctive quality, my subjective experience, to what I'm receiving through my association with Christianity. I just don't see that in conflict. It all seems to be about the relinquishment of what
okay.
I know as well, myself.
Well, okay, yeah, that's true. You're good to recognize that. It does have a lot to do with denying yourself and relinquishing your own will, in the sense of your own right to have your will. When we become a Christian, I still have a will, but I recognize that it has to be not my will but God's that I pursue. You know, I still might prefer something else, but if God wants it a certain way, that's what I am choosing to do. Now, in your case, you said earlier you don't really see a problem between your Buddhism, which you've been in for years, and the practice of it as you've been practicing it, and Christianity. But it sounds like you still do see a little bit of a conflict between those two, because I think you're having a hard time relinquishing the Buddhist identity in order to embrace a Christian identity. Isn't that really pretty much what's going on?
Well, in terms of my, not necessarily, because in terms of what I'm attempting to do, and I even hesitate to say, well, in a manner of speaking, but it seems to be bigger than me, but I'm relying on a wise association, which in India is called Satsang, and allowing the light to poke through and begin to reduce the power of the old
No. Well, Michael, you've drawn, over the years that you've been calling this show, you've drawn very close to becoming a Christian, or at least being very sympathetic toward Christianity.
Absolutely, yeah.
Many times, and then at times you've drawn back again. There is something, and I don't know what it is, but there is something that you seem to, you get this close, and then you say, no, I think I'll draw back again. And the real question has got to be, is Christianity true? Is Jesus who he said he is? Is he who Christians say he is? If he is, then there's really nothing for it but to go all in. If he's not who he says he is, then no matter how nice Christians seem to treat you, it's a big sham, and there's no reason to even give it much sympathy.
Oh, no, Steve, it's not about, like George and everybody has a Bible. Are very nice people. I've had some, you know, different experiences with other Christian people. So it's not on the basis of how I'm treated. It's on the basis of what I experience in my heart through connecting with the study group and the teaching.
Yeah.
It's not.
So you're sensing the Spirit of Christ there,
yes.
and that's manifest as love in your heart and so forth. Well, Michael, these are good things. Those are not new things with you, though. I mean, those are things you've said to me years ago and on many occasions. And
more vivid, much more vivid.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad that is how you're feeling about it, because you really need to, I think, somehow overcome whatever that last bit of resistance is that makes you hold back. But you need to really make a decision. Is this true or is it not true? And the feelings of the Spirit of Christ you say you feel when you're with Christians, those may be one of the indicators. So certainly is some of the evidence you would take into consideration, saying, is this the truth? You also need to look, of course, at the historical Jesus. I know you have, because I know you read the Gospels. And you have to decide, you know, did this really happen? Did Jesus really say these things? Is he really who they say he is? And then you've just got to, I mean, if the answer is yes, you're going to have to man up and say, you know, I am a Christian. I've been resisting it this long. There's been people praying for me because I'm a Buddhist, and they know I'm considering Christianity, and maybe they won't pray for me as much after I become a Christian. Maybe I won't, you know, have as much people thinking about me and so forth. But really, those considerations, you really just have to think, what does God think of me? What does Jesus think of me? What do I owe him? What should I do in terms of the truth of Jesus Christ? Michael, I've got my lines full.
All right, Steve, I appreciate your input. Thank you.
I appreciate your call, as usual.
Okay, talk to you later.
Okay, Michael, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Good talking to you. Bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Richard from West Lynn, Oregon. Richard, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. You and your wife visited our Sunday school class. Well, it's about a year ago now, I guess. But anyway.
Oh, yes, yes, I remember.
Right.
And then you took it out for lunch.
Yes.
That was delightful.
Well, we enjoyed it, too. And I wanted to say our class is studying Isaiah right now. And we're on the seventh chapter, and the king of Syria and the king of Israel
mm-hmm.
wanted to persuade the king of Judah join an alliance against Assyria.
That's right.
And do you have a scripture that would bear that out? My commentary agrees with your statement on your commentary on that, but I can't find a scripture that.
I think it's that's a good point. I'm not sure where it says this in 2 Kings, but I believe there'd be some hint of it in 2 Kings. I think most of the information about that actually is coming from the passage in Isaiah itself, because it says in verse 5, because Syria, Ephraim, and the son of Remalia have taken evil counsel against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and trouble it, and let us make a gap in its wall for ourselves and set a king over them, the son of Tabeel. And they says, it shall not stand. And then he goes on to warn that he should not fear them and certainly not join with them. I think it's implied. Knowing that Assyria was threatening all of the Middle Eastern countries, and Israel, Syria, and Judah were all very small and vulnerable countries, but they were hoping, at least two of them, were hoping that three of them could be have an alliance against Assyria and be strengthened by it, and Judah was holding out. So it looks like because Judah was holding out, the other two powers that weren't willing to take no for an answer were coming against Judah to conquer it, remove Ahaz, and put in someone, the son of Tabeel.
Right.
So I'm not really sure if there's a passage in 2 Kings, which is where this story would be found,
right,
that is that lays that out in so many words.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you very, very much for that. And
have you looked there? I could look there, but I can't do it on the air so easily. But have you gone to 2 Kings to try to look at this period of time?
Well, I did look at 2 Kings. I think it was chapter 16, I believe it was.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And I didn't find anything in there. But
yeah, maybe not. Yeah, I don't know if there is another place that says that. And I don't
know
what – I honestly don't know how much the commentators are informed by what we call extra-biblical information, because a lot
mm-hmm.
is known. A lot is known from extra-biblical archaeology and so forth about what was going on with these kings. These kings are all known from archaeology, and some of them are even known from pagan historical sources and things. And there may be sufficient explanation from these sources I'm not aware of. Like yourself, I've always just trusted the commentaries when they say that this is what was going on, and
right,
the wording of the passage, you know, fits well with that scenario, so I've never seriously doubted it. But when it comes down to, well, you know, how do we know that's exactly what was happening? I'm not sure I've ever asked that question. I have trusted the commentaries somewhat, so that's something to look into.
Right. Okay, well, thanks very much, Steve.
Okay, sorry, I can't be of better help to you.
Well, it's all right.
All right. God bless you, Richard.
God bless you, too.
Bye now. Okay, Everett from San Pablo, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Hi, Everett.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much. By the way, I have two questions. One question is, out of St. John chapter 14, when Jesus says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, the work that I do shall you do also, and greater work than these shall you do, because I go to my Father." When he's speaking with his apostles in that particular text, the works that I do shall you do, and greater works. What, in that context, in your understanding, what would be considered the works, and then what would be considered greater? And what does that mean?
Right. Well, when Jesus said to his apostles, the works that you see me do, you should also, he that believes in me shall do them, and shall do greater works, has led many people to believe that the works he's talking about are miracles, and that Christians should do greater miracles than Jesus did. But it's hard to imagine any miracles greater than what Jesus did. I mean, he raised the dead, he cleansed lepers, he opened the eyes of the blind, he walked on water, he turned water into wine. I don't know what miracles could be greater. I could think of some miracles that are the same miracles which were sometimes done by the apostles, or maybe of equal impressiveness, but greater? I don't know. Most commentators, however, believe that he's not necessarily talking about miracles. When he says the works I do, he doesn't necessarily say supernatural works. Jesus, the Bible talks about our faith is to be born out in our works. And, for example, in James chapter 2, and it talks about our works, it talks about feeding the poor. If you see a brother who's naked or destitute of daily food and you don't give him something, then you don't have the works that show you have faith. So works doesn't necessarily mean miracles that Jesus did. When he says the works I do, it could very well mean that the disciples will carry out the work of Jesus that he was doing the same kinds of works that he did, including miracles, but not exclusively of miracles, and the church will do it in a greater way, that is, in a broader way. Jesus did it as one man in a very limited geographical territory. The believers in Christ would go out all over the world and continue to multiply those works, and they'll do works greater in extent, maybe not in stupendousness. I can't imagine works more stupendous than those that Jesus did, but works more broadly, more expansively, more extensively than Jesus did. Because Jesus, for example, limited most of his works to evangelizing the lost sheep of the house of Israel, where his disciples would go out and continue his works and do them much more broadly throughout the Gentile world. So he may be speaking in those terms, and some commentators think that's what he's talking about. I'm not sure myself, but I think it's unlikely that he was saying you're going to do greater miracles than I did, because it's just frankly hard to imagine what a greater miracle than what he did would be.
Right, okay, gotcha. Well explained. Thank you so much for that. The other question I have real quickly is, when it says in St. John chapter 1, in the beginning was the Word, and then in 1 John chapter 1, it says that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which our eyes have looked upon, and our hands have handled the word of life, when it says that which was from the beginning and in the beginning, what is meant by that in the beginning?
Well, I think when John 1:1 says in the beginning was the Word, he's deliberately mimicking the opening words of Genesis. He's talking about the time, the beginning of world history, when in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. John is going to repeat that fact, that all things were created, but he's going to point out that they were created through the Word. In the beginning was the Word, and then he goes on to say, and all things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. So I think he's in the beginning means the same thing in John 1:1 as what it means in Genesis 1:1, which means at the beginning of God's activity. If God has been around eternally, then there was no beginning of God, for example. There's no beginning of eternity, but there's a beginning of God's activity with reference to the present universe and the present world and what we would call history, I guess. History began at a certain point when God created the heavens and the earth. And I think that's the beginning that John is referring to, because I think John is deliberately, as it were, quoting the opening words of Genesis in order to make another point about it, namely that, yes, in the beginning God created, but he did so through his Word. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God, and all things were made through him. And without him was not anything made that was made. The same was in the beginning with God. Now, in 1 John, he says that which was from the beginning, and later refers to that as the Word of life in the next verse or so. I think he's simply saying the same thing. The Word that was, created all things in the beginning is the one that he's referring to as that which was from the beginning. Now, there is a little difference in that the book of 1 John has many references to from the beginning. From the beginning, and it's not always the same beginning, because he says, for example, let that remain in you which you heard from the beginning. Well, from the beginning would be from the beginning of your Christian life, would have to be, not the beginning of the universe. But when he, from the beginning, always has to be qualified by the beginning of what? And First John, as a book, uses the term from the beginning quite a bit, not always referring to the same beginning, depends on the context. But at the beginning of the book, when he says that which was from the beginning, and he refers to it as the word of life, he's certainly referring to the same thing that he referred to in the opening of the book of John. At least I can't imagine it being otherwise.
Right, got you. Thank you for the explanation. It's very clear. I really appreciate it. God bless. Peace and blessings to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Everett. Good talking to you. Our next caller is Phil from Antioch, California. Phil, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, how you doing? I have a question. When I go through trials, I hear, like in my spirit, some people have a heavier cross to bear. Is that like... I know bearing your crosses, I know crucifying your flesh daily, I've gone through that. God wants you pure. He wants you to live with the least sin as possible and always be in communion with him, like John 15. But can you explain to me, is there another definition for you have a heavy cross to bear? Does that mean because you went through a tragedy or you can't have something that you want or you have to stay single or something like that? So I keep hearing that in my spirit. You have a heavy cross to bear.
So you're asking what that phrase would mean, or you're asking
I know what bear your cross means. To me, I've always had it. I've always thought it meant the crucifying of your flesh, like daily, like you die daily.
Well, I mean that certainly is one aspect of it. When Jesus said, if anyone come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, I don't think the idea of crucifying your flesh was immediately obvious to his listeners as the meaning. But we, as we have come to understand more about the cross and what Jesus went through, we could certainly see that as a part of it. I think when Jesus said, take up your cross, the disciples would have thought of that as either literal or metaphorical. And if it was metaphorical, which no doubt they would have understood it to be, because Jesus himself hadn't borne a cross yet, and they weren't knowing he would, necessarily. I think they would have seen bearing a cross to represent, you know, enduring the rejection and the shame of society. You see, a person was crucified when they were condemned to death for a crime, but being crucified just refers to them being nailed to the cross. Bearing a cross means you're carrying it, and this was prior to crucifixion. This was actually what a criminal was sometimes made to do as he was bearing the burden of his cross to the place where he would be crucified. But the main idea of bearing the cross would be that you are being publicly on display as a loser, as one condemned, as somebody that is rejected by society and condemned by the world. And therefore, I think what he's saying is, you need to deny yourself and accept the rejection and the scorn of the world if you're going to follow me. Now, when it comes to crucifying the flesh and its lusts, or crucifying the world, or I'm crucified to the world and so forth, the terms that Paul uses usually in Galatians, I'm crucified with Christ, he is using the word crucified there, perhaps a little differently than bearing the cross, but certainly the two are not unrelated to each other, because crucified means to be nailed to a cross. But you're nailed to a cross at a different time than you're carrying a cross. Bearing a cross is, I think, refers to one aspect of the Christian life, and being crucified refers to another. You bear the cross day by day. You walk in human society experiencing the scorn of man because you're a Christian, and that's bearing your cross. Now, what goes on internally in your heart by, distancing yourself from your lusts and your desires, crucifying yourself from the world or whatever, these have more to do with, in my opinion, what's going on inside you, whereas bearing a cross has to do with your outward display of following Christ visibly in society and experiencing their rejection because of it. In any case, if some people have heavier crosses to bear, I guess I would just see that fairly simply as meaning some people have more more trials, more difficulties. That doesn't really sound like it doesn't sound like it'd be a real mysterious meaning. I mean, certainly lots of people have greater trials than the average person does. I'm not really sure exactly what you're asking me about this.
Oh yeah, I just hear that because you know I went going through some stuff and questions. My stuff, you know, God lets me go through stuff to grow me, and I've been saved for a long time. But you know, through lately, He's been my eyes are being open to Christianity. You know how it's been preached and taught in some places. Happy-go-lucky, feel-good experience. And,
yeah, well,
you know,
Christianity,
that's not right, you know.
Yeah, that's not the way that Christianity should be preached. It is sometimes preached in our society that way. But Christianity is the bearing of a cross. It's not going to a party. All right. Thank you, Phil, for your call. Let's talk to John from McMinnville. We have time just for one more call. Hi, John.
Hey there, Steve. God bless you today. Hey.
Thank you.
I know that we're short on time. Let's keep this real short. A little bit of a different call here. You know, something I said in the program earlier today just brought a lot of joy to me, and that's hearing my call in and share what he did. And I just wanted to just share really quickly. You know, Michael, I trust you're still listening to the show, and it seems like a lot of us have kind of gotten to know you over the years. I feel kind of like you're a friend, even though we've never met. But
you and I have never met, right?
No, I'm talking about Michael.
Oh, Michael. Oh, that Michael.
Like,
okay, gotcha.
I feel like Michael is a friend, even though we've never met.
Yeah, Michael the Buddhist. Yes, of course, right.
Yeah, you know, he's been calling in for so many years. And, you know, Michael, I'll just let you know, a lot of us have been listening to the program. You've got a lot of people that love you, and we're praying for you a lot. To hear you say that you're so close to becoming a Christian, that's like one of the best things I've heard on this show. Steve, you're a great Bible answer guy, but that's pretty good right there, hearing him say that.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And, you know, I just want to encourage you just to keep seeking and keep your heart open, Michael, because I'm looking forward to, and we're all looking forward to you calling in someday and just saying, you know what, I'm at that point where I'm acknowledging the Lordship of Christ, and I'll tell you what, that's going to be the best program that I can think on this program here. I don't know if anyone else has called in like that, Steve, but I just wanted to, you know, let you know, Michael, we all love you, and we're praying for you, and we're looking forward to that day.
Well, John, I would echo that. But you know probably, John, that as Michael has been calling for many years, there are listeners who have told me you shouldn't put up with that guy. He's just, you know, he just isn't, he's not moving. He's not changing. He's just wasting time on the air. But there's others, and probably more, who are like you, who say, man, I'm following the saga of Michael, you know, for the past 10 years on the Narrow Path program, you know. But it is true that it has been a frustration for some because, frankly, I've been having these conversations with Michael, and he's been very close before. And then sometimes he'll get skittish and back away. But you're right. I mean, you and a lot of other people are going to be eager to hear the time when he actually calls and says, well, I finally did it. I just became a Christian. And so I thank you, John, for passing that along. We're pretty much out of time for today's program, so I'm going to have to end the call and just make a few announcements. But, John, thank you for your call. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have some new listening audiences right now. Just this month, we picked up audience in Spokane and Coeur d'Alene area. And for a very short time, we've been on in Austin, Texas, and Omaha, Nebraska. And we just want all those callers in that area to become acquainted with our ministry, not only the radio show, which is on daily at this time, but also our website, thenarrowpath.com, where we have tons and tons of resources, lectures, archived radio shows, all kinds of stuff. It's MP3s. Everything's free. You just download it, and you can benefit from it, as others say they have. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry. Everything at the website is free, but if you'd like to help us pay the bills to stay on the air, you may help us by writing to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can, of course, donate from the website, which again is thenarrowpath.com. Have a good weekend, and let's talk again Monday. God bless.